Welcome to this Microsoft Virtual Academy session on failover clustering in Windows Server 2012 R2. I'm Simon, joined once again by Eldon. In this module, we're going to be taking a look at virtualization, specifically the best practices around building your virtualization solution and running your Hyper-V VMs on top of a failover cluster. In this module, first we're going to talk about Hyper-V clustering in general, some of the best practices around that. We're going to take a look at deploying our virtual machines, managing and optimizing them on top of the clustering, and then two kind of specific scenarios. One, looking at VM monitoring, where we go and actually monitor the services running inside guest operating systems. And then secondly, going and creating a guest cluster. And again, that guest cluster is an entirely virtualized failover cluster, where you have Windows Server running inside the VMs with an application which moves between those VMs. Well, let's get started talking about our basics on Hyper-V clustering. Now, once again, I want to emphasize that we have a completely free host SKU available for your Hyper-V virtual machines. It supports all of those same clustering features, 64 nodes, 8,000 VMs, cluster shared volumes, live migration, replication, all those good things. So definitely consider deploying this. As far as guest operating system support, we want to really try to make sure that we can support all of the core Windows Server and client. Now, you'll see that we go back and we support multiple versions from 2003 all the way up to 2012 R2, as well as several other flavors of Windows Server. For clients, we support everything from XP onwards, but we've also started to really develop a good virtualization story for Linux as well. Now here you can see several of the Linux distributions, and we're really committed to this so much so that Microsoft has actually hired some of the top Linux engineers, and they're actually checking code, Hyper-V code, into the Linux kernel itself. Things such as our integration components and integration services, things that allow us to be aware of dynamic memory, 64 virtual CPUs, to really make Linux a first-class citizen when it runs on Hyper-V. So if you want to go see that list again, that's aka.ms/guest-os-list, and that will show you the current list of our Linux and Windows distributions. Now, Hyper-V clusters are different. We mentioned earlier that we have a whole new set of validation tests specific for Hyper-V clusters, and it's going to take a look at things like network adapter names, virtual networks, things like that. We also have a different way of updating our cluster database. Now, when we kind of talked in the first module, we talked about this cluster database being this single consistent store of information that is replicated to the other cluster nodes so that they have the single consistent view of what's happening in the cluster. Now, the challenge that we saw when we started to have large virtualized clusters, 64 nodes, is when we were making a change and pushing that replicated information of the database to 64 nodes, it would take a while for us to send it and also receive an acknowledgement back to commit that transaction. So we said, you know what, this doesn't really make sense for Hyper-V clusters. So we've gone and we've changed that internal algorithm slightly, and now we don't require all of the nodes to respond and give an acknowledgement that they've seen this update. We only require half of them. And so this means that virtual machines are going to come online faster, recover faster, and you're just going to get generally better performance in the cluster. When we looked at our networking, one of the other things we talked about earlier was how we changed the heartbeat settings to really try to make sure that these are happening less frequently in the Hyper-V cluster so that we're not triggering false or premature failovers. So really, from your perspective, you don't need to think about these. These are internal. These are things that are happening automatically with our goals of really trying to help optimize that cluster. Let's talk about deploying our virtual machines on top of the cluster now. Well, within our validation test, we're going and really making sure that the virtual machines are going to function correctly. Now, one of the most common misconfigurations that we see here is people will have different virtual switch names across the different nodes in the cluster. So this means if the VM is using corp1 and the VM has to move to a different node in the cluster, it also wants to see a switch that uses corp1. Because in that virtual machine's configuration file, we're actually specifying the name of that virtual network connection. So we're going to test things like that, make sure that you have consistency across all of the nodes in the cluster to make sure that those VMs are going to run successfully. Well, when we go and actually deploy our VMs on the cluster, we've actually tried to integrate Hyper-V components as much as possible. So if you're already familiar with Hyper-V and Hyper-V Manager, you're going to see a lot of the same wizards present themselves through Failover Cluster Manager, such as when we go and view the settings of a VM, when we go create a VM, and we're going to be demoing those shortly. Now, you could go and create a new VM on a cluster, or if you already have existing Hyper-V hosts that have formed a cluster, you could go and add those standalone virtual machines and make them cluster aware so that the cluster essentially provides high availability for the VMs. So we'll make sure that it can fail over, support live migration, have that distributed access. We also allow you to import virtual machines on the cluster and migrate it from older versions. One of the last features that we're going to be talking about as well is Hyper-V Replica, one of our inbox replication and disaster recovery solutions. But even though this module is focused on virtualization, we're really going to save the details of that for our next module as we take a look at multi-site clustering and disaster recovery. Let's go ahead and I'm going to switch over to my cluster now, and we're actually just going to go and create our first clustered virtual machine. So I'm back to using my cluster that we were taking a look at the start of the day, which has our three nodes. And under our roles, I haven't gone and deployed anything yet. What we're going to do is we're going to go and create this virtual machine, and we're going to go and store the virtual hard disk over on Eldon's scale-out file server. So we're kind of doing a two-part demo here. Eldon created the scale-out file server as one cluster. I'm now going to use this Hyper-V cluster to go run my virtual machines, pointing to that namespace on Eldon's cluster. So kind of a two-layered virtualization topology here. So I'm going to select role here and new virtual machine. We'll select our local node, click OK. And this is going to launch one of the wizards that you're probably familiar with, our new virtual machine wizard. Now, Eldon, we have not actually recreated these wizards, right? We're actually calling the Hyper-V code and actually pulling those exact same wizards into Failover Cluster Manager, is that right?
Yeah, we try to kind of bring the experience together by showing some things within Failover Cluster, by really kind of bringing that Hyper-V and Failover Cluster Manager experience together. And they're really just shortcuts, so we're just exposing and reflecting and launching their wizards for you from shortcuts out of Failover Cluster Manager.
Great. Well, let's go ahead and we'll call this our VM for the MVA. And we will say high availability. Now, here's the key thing. Where are we going to go and store this virtual machine? Well, if I'm going to deploy it on a cluster, I'm never going to want to just store it on my local disk because it's not highly available. If that node goes down, I don't have access to my virtual hard disk, nor my configuration files, nor checkpoints. So if I wanted to go deploy this on a, you know, traditional cluster or a CSV disk, I would go specify the space here, the namespace. In this case, we're going to go and deploy this on Eldon's cluster, whack whack Eldon C, SOFS, my VMs. So this was that share that Eldon created earlier that's highly available and redundant. We'll click Next. Now I select the same type of information, what type of VM, what's my startup memory, do I want to use dynamic memory, do I want to connect to a network? And we'll just keep these same default settings. This isn't intended to be a course on virtualization. It's really focusing on how you run and optimize those VMs on the cluster. Now, quickly look, here's a second wizard that suddenly appeared. What you actually saw was that new virtual machine wizard finish, which created the new VM, and then we automatically invoked our cluster wizard that went and added that VM to the cluster, making it highly available. So we now see that this VM has been made highly available. So we'll click Finish, and take a look at that. We now see our VM. Now, Eldon, one thing I've noticed here is that the virtual machines, when I create them on a cluster, they're immediately offline. Why do we keep VMs in an offline state when we first deploy them?
So it's a part of it is consistency with what Hyper-V Manager does. So Hyper-V Manager, when you first provision VMs, you can do, like, you're going to provision 1,000 VMs, and then whether you want to start them up or not. So we just kind of have consistency with the way Virtual Machine Manager and the way you create VMs.
Now, another thing that a lot of people we find want to do is still make additional configuration settings with their VMs. So just like in Hyper-V Manager, if we take a look at our summary dashboard, we get status about the VMs. Remember, it's currently off, so we're not going to see any live data. But we also have the ability to go in and adjust the settings, just like we would through Hyper-V Manager. And this interface should be pretty familiar. Now, since this is a Generation 2 VM, you're going to see things such as our ability to do secure boot, our ability to no longer have a legacy network adapter. So we're really making sure that we follow and embrace the latest enhancements with Hyper-V as well. All right, well, we'll close those. Now we'll go ahead and actually start this virtual machine. We can see it starting up. And if we go take a look at our virtual machine resources here, we can see that my configuration is online. And we now see that my virtual machine is running. So it looks like I've got my initial VM up and running here. Now, if I wanted to do things such as live migration, I'd have the option to go and, where are we? Migration. Here we go. Move my VM here. So move it, live migration, or quick migration, selecting these different options. And we'll talk a little bit more about what those options mean in a minute. All right, so we've gone and created our basic VM. Let's go back to the presentation and talk a little bit more about how we can manage and optimize our VMs in a cluster. So we have a lot of different configurations, and everything that we're going to cover right now, unless we specifically say so, is actually going to be applicable to all different types of workloads. Some things are just specific to VMs, we'll tell you what those are, but a lot of the best practices we're going to tell you are broadly applicable to any type of workload, such as your clustered file servers, DHCP servers, whatever it may be. Now, the first setting that you're going to want to think about is configuring what we call preferred owners and possible owners. Now, essentially, this is ranking your host as my first place and my second place hosts. So let's say, for example, over time, you have some older cluster nodes, then you buy more. And you may have a cluster that doesn't have identical hardware. So long as it passes validation, it's going to be supported. But then you may have some monster VMs, VMs that require 128 gigs of RAM, and maybe they're not really designed to go run on those old hosts. Well, what you'd want to do here is you would go and say, this particular VM, I always want to run on host 5, so long as host 5 is available. And we essentially create an affinity between that one VM and that particular host or set of hosts. Now, you get to rank them as well, saying, here's my number one choice, number two choice, etc. But what happens if none of those first place choices are available? None of my preferred owners are available? In that case, we go to kind of our second best, our last resort, which is called a possible owner. This basically says if none of my top choices are available, I then want to go move my VM to a second place choice. Now, Eldig, if neither the first or the second place is available, neither the preferred or possible, we actually don't start that VM, right? We'll move it to a host, but we won't bring it online. Is that the semantics?
So if you have a preferred in the preferred owners, with the first and second and the third node?
So if there's no preferred owners available and no possible owners available.
Yeah, then so it's really defined by the possible owner. So with the preferred owner setting, it's saying, hey, where do I want to go if possible? And then, where do I want to go? And then possible owners is, can I go? Can I go? And if there's no possible owner, that VM's going to stay in an offline site, absolutely.
So I think the best practice that we recommend, you know, if you need to do affinity, go set that first place preferred. By default, you're probably going to want to keep all of your nodes as a possible owner. Most people would rather have their application online, even if it's performing slow, than have it stay offline entirely. Our next set of settings are what we call persistent mode. Now, this was actually available in the UI in 2008 R2. But in 2012 and later, we've hidden this and just turned it on by default. So you're actually seeing a screenshot here of a 2008 R2 cluster node, just to kind of emphasize the name of this setting here. Now, what persistent mode does is it basically says that a certain virtual machine will try to run on the last node that it was purposely moved to in the event of a crash. So let's take a step back and look at a disaster scenario. I have, let's say, 100 virtual machines running on 10 cluster nodes. Well, if I start to have a series of events that gradually brings down the cluster, my first node goes down, the VMs fail over. Second node goes down, VMs move. And so we'll get to a point where we have very few nodes, as long as we still maintain quorum, and they're going to be running tons and tons of VMs on them. Now, what would happen in the past? The cluster, it might crash. As soon as nodes started coming online, and we had quorum, all 100 of those VMs would try to go to that first possible node that came online. They would actually overwhelm those nodes. They would create what we call a startup storm, where there's too much trying to happen on one of those nodes. And if you kind of think about what happens when you start any computer or any virtual machine, and you look at kind of the compute pattern, when you start that VM, it usually has a bit of a burst because we're loading a ton of information. We're loading drivers, file systems, storage, network, running startup scripts, booting the operating system. So we usually have a burst when we first start the VMs, then it will stabilize. So imagine if you had 100 VMs that should be across 10 nodes. You now only have 4 or 5 nodes that are online, and those VMs are trying to start on them at the same time. That's the problem that we designed this scenario to avoid, this overwhelming the nodes. Now, when this is turned on, what's going to happen is when the first host come online and we have quorum, the nodes that were last purposely moved to this The last VMs that were purposely moved to this node will come online. So only 10 are going to come online here. And only 10 will come online here. 10, 10, 10. So this essentially gives the entire cluster and each of its nodes an opportunity to gracefully start up before we try to start overwhelming. Now, my understanding is, what happens if one of the nodes never comes online? Is there some type of timing? Are those VMs just always going to stay offline and never start?
So there's basically a timeout. So what will happen is that when the virtual machines, when the cluster goes and start, the preference is to try to go put those VMs back where they were last running. We have a timeout that if that node doesn't come back, it's actually configurable, and we have a cluster property. You can modify it if you want. But we'll wait a couple minutes. I think it's like 3 minutes. And we'll wait a few minutes, and then we'll see if that node comes back up. And if it doesn't, then we'll say, oh, that node's not coming back. Let's go put it somewhere else. And then we'll follow the failover policies we talked about using preferred owners and possible owners and try to place it on the best node.
And hopefully after we've waited that several-minute period, that startup storms kind of lessen, things will be a little quieter. So moving one more VM onto that host shouldn't be as disruptive as trying to push everything on there on the cold start. The next property you want to think about is what we call anti-affinity. Now, this is actually not anti-affinity between the VMs and the host. This is anti-affinity between the VMs themselves. So the way we go and configure this, we have an internal cluster property known as anti-affinity class name. And we essentially give each virtual machine a tag, such as red. What's going to happen is we're going to purposely try to distribute those red virtual machines across different hosts. So if two virtual machines have a tag, we'll go and actually move them and push them across different hosts. So taking a look at the example here, we see that I have four virtual machines that have been tagged as red. I have four hosts, so those VMs are purposely going to try to distribute themselves. Now, this is important to help avoid those single points of failure. Let's say that my entire domain controller infrastructure is virtualized. I have two domain controllers and two VMs. Well, I'm going to want to spread those out across different hosts. I don't want two domain controllers on a single host, because if I lose that host, I've lost both of my domain controllers. So we would assign a class name to them such as DC, and they'll purposely distribute themselves across the different hosts. Another example could be if you have a guest cluster node. So again, that guest cluster is a cluster made up entirely of VMs. If I have a four-node guest cluster, I don't want it running on a single host. I lose that host, I've lost my entire guest cluster. So again, we'll go and push those out. Hosters, for example, they may also have a requirement to keep tenants on different hosts. You know, we use the example of the two most popular soda companies. If they're in a hosted environment, well, one that starts with a C goes here, the one that starts with a P goes over here, making sure that those tenants stay separate as well. So lots of different best practices for here. Now, this is kind of hidden in Failover Cluster Manager, but if you use System Center Virtual Machine Manager, you'll see this exposed as an availability set inside the GUI, and you can basically go tag the different VMs, place them in an availability set, and then they'll distribute themselves. Now, next concept that we want to talk about here, again, not unique to virtual machines, but optimized for them, is prioritization. Now, what we do for prioritization is we can essentially tag a VM as high, medium, low, or this fourth option, no auto start, which we'll talk about in a minute. Now, if you have this cold start and you want to start all of your VMs up at once, chances are some VMs are more important than others. Maybe you have dependencies such as you need to start up your backend databases before your front-end web servers. Maybe you need to start your domain controllers before you start your application servers. But using this internal ranking and prioritization, we'll start our high first, then medium, then low. Now, this same logic also gets honored if we do other types of management operations, such as maintenance, shutting down nodes, and we'll talk a little more about what those management tasks are shortly. The final one here, the fourth option we see, is called no auto start. What no auto start does is we basically say, if this VM crashes or the cluster crashes, we're just gonna wait for the admin to manually restart that. So again, let's take a scenario where our entire cluster fails, everything goes offline. Well, let's get our domain controllers up high priority, line of business medium priority, other internal apps low priority, and then maybe things like marketing or business development or all of those, you know, less sexy things like what I'm being moved into. those VMs, they get to stay and wait. You know, we don't need to start them. They're not business critical. So once the key infrastructure is healthy, back up and running, we could go manually turn those on. And you could do things such as run a script, you know, go start them up after an hour. So manual, you could kind of use that term flexibly, and you know, you can go actually trigger it automatically if you want. Now, next set of concepts is around live migration. We've talked about live migration quite a lot already, and it's just basically moving that running VM between hosts. And we essentially do that by copying the running memory from one node to another node. Now, we've supported live migration since 2008 R2, correct?
Yep.
Okay, so we've had this for a couple releases now. Each release, we make it a little better. Some of the key enhancements in this release are supporting concurrent live migrations. Now, we actually don't have a limit on the maximum number of concurrent live migrations. Really, the limit is going to be based on your network throughput, network latency. And so, as a best practice, you don't want to go turn this up to 1,000. You kind of want to do some testing and find what is your sweet spot. Now, people ask, you know, where exactly does that lie? We find it's somewhere between 5 and 10 simultaneous live migrations. There's so many factors that can cause that to vary. Your hardware, and even what type of application is running inside the guest operating system. Things such as SQL databases that have lots of disk writes there, or memory changes, they're going to take longer to migrate than something like a thin client application where someone's browsing Internet Explorer. So just kind of do some testing, figure out what's the right number.
Things like RDMA-enabled NICs, so if you're using, well, you're using SMB with compression, SMB, or I should say live migration with compression, or live migration without compression, or live migration with SMB, if you're using RDMA-enabled NICs, so if you got RDMA-enabled NICs, you can offload that CPU cycles, you can get more live migrations and in parallel going.
Great. Next one we have is live migration queuing. So let's say you can do 10 simultaneous live migrations. You're live migrating 100 VMs. Well, it will do 10 at a time, 10 at a time, 10 at a time. And if you go and trigger a live migration by putting a node into maintenance, we're going to go and honor that prioritization. So we live migrate high priority first, medium low. We have live migration compression. We've certainly talked about this already, speeding things up. We do compression before we send it across, uncompress it on the other side. As Eldon alluded to, if you have hardware-assisted NICs, that's going to speed things up as well. Live migration over RDMA. Now, one of the other things that I showed you back when I was showing the demo was this best available node, where I clicked on a virtual machine and I said, move this to the best available node. What is best available node? How do we determine what that is?
So what we do is actually we do this in placement. We're using the same logic we use during placement. So when you say best possible, or let's just say failover placement, failover logic placement. So what we do is that we go and we look at the virtual machine and we look at the initial start requirements of the memory. Then we go look and query across each and every server to figure out what is its free available memory. And then we will actually place. So in placement, we make sure that we find a VM, a node which has sufficient VM, and then has the lowest VM count. So we'll go and actually figure out which node has the most available memory. We'll go and place it in the equal scenarios. We'll use the lowest count. But it's really about looking at that memory and then placing. And then we use the preferred owners as a hint. So we're saying, okay, what are the preferred owners? Is that node available? What's the available memory and possible owners as well?
So essentially, you know, if you guys are familiar with System Center Virtual Machine Manager, they have a feature known as intelligent placement where you can say memory is most important to me. This is kind of using a similar concept where we're prioritizing memory, but also factoring all of those other cluster configurations too. Now in this release, we did some other more flexible things with live migration as well. Now in the past, when we did a live migration, it had to be within a single cluster. So from node one to node two. But we had customers that said, you know what, I want to go live migrate my virtual hard disk, keep the VM on the same host. So in this latest release, we make sure that we support that with no downtime to the running VM. So let's say, for example, you need to do some maintenance on your storage, or maybe you even need to test some cluster storage and you don't want to take the VM offline. Well, you could storage live migrate that VM somewhere else, go test your cluster disks, make sure they're healthy, do that full validation test, afterwards, live migrate it back. We have live migration over an SMB connection. So we can now live migrate out of clusters. We can live migrate over a network. So we're no longer bound with live migration within a cluster. This means that we can go from cluster to cluster, standalone to standalone, or any other combination. We have shared nothing live migration. And in this case, we're simultaneously moving that virtual hard disk and we're moving the VMs in the in-state memory at the same time. So this can even allow us to do things such as live migrate from a standalone host with DAS to another standalone host with DAS. Now, One challenge that I've heard, when we start to speak with customers about, hey, there's this flexible live migration, you're no longer required to have a cluster, people sometimes say, well, do I still really need a cluster? Don't forget, clustering is still important for that unplanned downtime. Live migration is a great solution when you need to do maintenance, you know that you're going to have to take things offline, and you have an opportunity to gracefully move them around. But anytime you do a live migration, both of the nodes need to be online and participating, so it has to be planned. If you have a hard crash, this is still where clustering adds a lot of value. We detect the crash, we restart the VM, we fail it over. So clustering is absolutely not out of the picture just because we've enhanced our live migration story here. The fourth new type of live migration is not quite live migration. It's actually a type of replication, which we call Hyper-V replica. So if we take a look at the screen here, we'll see that we have our SAN in one location, and we're actually replicating the virtual hard disk over to an entirely second location. The start of our next module, we're going to actually configure this and walk you through some of the settings. So we won't be spending too long on that now. Now, maintenance mode is another management task which we can use that really just simplifies host maintenance. So let's say you need to go and take a node offline because you've got to go replace a NIC, something like that, where it'll purposely be offline. Well, one way to simplify offloading all the workloads on it is by going through this option of pausing the node. If you take a look at the actual screenshot here, you'll see there's two options. We can pause it and drain the VMs, or we could pause it and keep the VMs on that same host. But essentially, when we're pausing it, we're kind of locking it. We're making sure that nothing's going to move onto it. So this is a great solution. You know, if you're going to go do maintenance, you have 100 VMs on the host, put it into maintenance, go grab lunch, come back, everything will have lined up. It will have live migrated based on priority, high priority first, using the concurrent live migrations, using live migration queuing, and hopefully when you're back, everything will have been drained, so you can then shut down that host, do your maintenance, whatever you need. Now, one scenario that was particularly interesting here, especially as we started to get to these hosters that had these massive servers, we had customers that were accidentally shooting themselves in the feet. They would have a virtualization host that was clustered, they would be running a bunch of VMs on it, and then they might have somebody that's doing patching across the host and just wasn't even aware it was a cluster node. They'd install their patches, they would click shutdown, and they would accidentally kill their virtual machines on it. So we've actually built some logic now into our shutdown mechanism that ensures that we give our VMs a chance to drain. Eldon, maybe can you talk a little bit more about the internals of kind of the logic of what's happening there?
Yeah, so it actually uses the same logic as node maintenance mode. So it'll actually go and determine what are all the VMs that are running this host, and then it will go and, so let's talk about node maintenance mode, what the logic is. So what it does is it goes and looks at all the virtual machines that are running on this host. It sticks them in a queue. Then it prioritizes the queue based on the priority of the VM. So highs first, mediums, and then lows, and then it will go and initiate live migrations and simultaneous live migrations. So we'll get the high priority ones off first, then the mediums, then the lows. And the live migration during shutdown effectively does the same thing as it goes and goes to migrate them all off and then pauses the node so nothing new comes to it. But you should always do node maintenance mode first. So we built in this feature on shutdown, just kind of like, I like to think of it as like the safety on the gun. Like just in case like you made a mistake and you forgot there were VMs and you shut down, we're gonna do everything in our power to protect you. But I still recommend just as an operational best practice, you always wanna do node maintenance mode first. And what that's really about is you'll pause the node and then when you reboot it, it'll still be paused and not taking it back until you're ready. So still do node maintenance mode. Don't rely on this. This is just the safety on the gun.
Great. Well, let's actually go switch over to our demo now, and we'll take a look at where you can go find some of these settings. Okay, so I'm back to my cluster here, back to the virtual machine that I've created. And first thing we could do is we could go and select the properties of this virtual machine. Under these properties, this is where you'll get to find your preferred owners. And again, this is that first place choice. Now, by default, we don't go and select any of these. We assume that everything's equal. We treat all of your nodes as equal. Second thing that we're going to see here is if we take a look at the virtual machine resource file, we can click the properties. This is where we actually get to go and configure our possible owners. Where is that? That's under the wrong one here. There we go.
There you go.
That's under the virtual machine configuration file. So this is where we go and give our second place choices the possible owners. And you can see that these are all enabled by default here. So those are two of the placement settings that we have. When we click on a VM, either over in the taskbar or by right-clicking on it, we get some of those other settings. So traditional management tasks connecting to the VM, changing the configuration settings. Managing will actually initiate a connection to that VM. We have replication settings, our live migration settings. This is where we see the best possible node in the select mode. Actually, one thing we didn't talk about, Eldon, what is the difference between a live migration and a quick migration? I think that's very relevant for virtualization.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So quick migration, so the difference is a live migration is going to go and move all the run state of the virtual machine over the network across the other nodes. So it's done with zero downtime, and we just do a copy of the in-state memory from one node to the other one across Ethernet, across the network. With a quick migration, it actually is doing a save state. So it'll take all the contents of memory of that virtual machine, it will then save it down to disk, and then it will go in and resume that VM on the other side. So it's about, so one, live migration pushes across the network, where quick migration pushes down over storage. Quick migration, there is some downtime. Live migration, no downtime.
That's a good point, whether you have that downtime or not. Now, in some cases, though, people say quick migration is faster than live migration. Is that accurate?
Well, it could be. So with a quick migration, it's actually taking all the contents of memory and just pushing it, shutting down the VM and save stating and pushing it down to storage, which you could have very fast storage and push it across. If you have slow networking and you have a VM which is changing a lot, it could take a long time to copy the large amount of data over the network. And if you have a lot of changes going on in the VM, remember that's happening live, it could take multiple iterations to get all the data pushed across, and that could slow down your network. So a quick migration could take, the way to think about it is if you're doing maintenance on the weekend and you have a maintenance window and you know nobody's accessing it, you might want to do a quick migration because it's going to get all those VMs off that machine as fast as possible. Where if you're doing maybe patching in the middle of the day, of production, then you probably want to do, then you absolutely want to do a live migration because you want that zero downtime promise, but you don't care how long that brownout window is.
Thanks for clarifying. All right, so continuing down, looking at some of the properties here, you'll see that we have our startup priority. Pretty easy to go configure, pretty easy to change. And then under more actions, one thing I'm going to point out, but we'll talk about a little later, is this other one for configure monitoring. So I just want to show you this is where we expose it. We're going to jump back to our presentation, and we're going to be talking about VM monitoring very, very shortly. So what is VM monitoring? Well, we actually break this down into two parts. The first type of monitoring is monitoring the guest operating system itself, preventing things like user mode hangs and system crashes. So think of if your VM blue screens. We want to be able to protect against that. This setting is now on by default, enable the heartbeat monitoring for the virtual machine. So again, we detect a problem, we can restart the VM, we can move it to a different node. The second type of monitoring is our VM monitoring. This is a more advanced configuration setting and requires you to turn things on both on the host as well as inside the guest operating system of the VM. So one thing to consider if you're doing this, you need to make sure that if you're a hoster, you're working with the tenant on this. This is not a host-only configuration setting, nor is it a guest-only configuration setting. Both the host and the hoster and the tenant using that VM have to work together to go and turn this on. Essentially, what deep monitoring does is it allows us to monitor any service that's running inside that virtual machine. So let's take a look at our print spooler, for example. In the past, print used to be a highly available workload where it would run directly on a failover cluster and move over, but it had some performance issues. For example, it had to go drain out existing print queues before a failover, and sometimes it would just cause failover to take a long time. So we kind of rethought this and said, well, print spooler, if someone loses a couple print jobs, probably not the end of the world. Let's put that print spooler service inside a VM and make the fact that it's virtualized and the VM can fail over and move, make that be our high availability story. But we still need to make sure we're monitoring that service, making sure it stays healthy, because we don't want the spooler service to just crash, come online, crash, and just keep doing that. Let's say, for example, that this virtual machine required a specific cluster network that for some reason wasn't accessible on the host. Yet if we moved that VM to a different host, that virtual network would be accessible, the VM would run. That's the scenario that we're really trying to optimize with deep monitoring here. So let's take a look at this in a little more detail. This is where we have to go and turn on our second checkbox here, and then we have to go turn on our firewall setting for virtual machine monitoring. What we then do is we basically go and pick the particular service we're monitoring. We'll go do reboots. We'll go fail over the VM if a reboot is not successful. So basically, it allows our host to control our VMs based on whether the service inside that VM is healthy or not. Now, the way we actually do this is we're actually taking a look at the event log that is running within that guest operating system. Anytime a service crashes, the event log will generate an event 1250 saying one of these services has crashed, and we keep track of how many times we see these services crash by just monitoring this event log. We see one crash, two crash, and then once we start to see more than that, that's when the cluster will go jump in and go try to take some more advanced recovery actions. Now, next thing we do is once we've gone and configured this within the VM, we go and turn this setting on from our host. We go specify which of our actual guest services we want to monitor, and then we've got this solution running. So again, within the print spooler, it can crash once, okay, crash twice, okay, crash the third time. We want the cluster to go start to try to take these more advanced recovery actions. Within the guest, configuration does require running a few different PowerShell commandlets. They're here. But what I'd really recommend when you go turn this on, go take a look at this blog that was written. That will really walk you through step by step all of these different configuration settings to get up and running. Our final topic is guest clustering. We've mentioned this many times already today, and this is where we create our cluster made out of virtual machines. We still have those same requirements that Windows Server has to be installed within the VM. We need some type of shared storage. We need to ensure that the entire solution passes validation. But assuming that we meet those same standard requirements, we don't really care whether you're running a physical cluster or a virtualized cluster. Now, what we're really trying to focus on here with guest clustering is that high availability within the VMs. So going back to one of the scenarios we discussed early, I have a virtualized SQL server. I want to make sure that if that SQL server crashes, we restart. Or if I need to do something like maintenance on the SQL server, I could go do a failover between the other virtualized nodes. So again, host clustering versus guest clustering. With our host, we're managing VMs, moving them between different physical nodes. With our guest, we're managing those applications within the VMs. If you take a look at health detection, guest clustering, we can go peek in a little further and we're able to actually fail over and provide high availability for that SQL server or that other component running within the guest OS. As we take a look at our storage options, we have similar storage options, but kind of a few caveats here. So Fibre Channel, this is supported with Windows Server 2012 and later with Hyper-V. And that's because the 2012 release introduced a virtualized HBA that Hyper-V can use, allowing you to connect your VMs to Fibre Channel. If you're using serial attached SCSI, SAS, this is supported with a concept known as that shared VHDX. I think we're going to talk a little more about that later. Eldon mentioned it earlier, but it's to scan a single disk which two different nodes can share, basically a virtual hard disk. We support iSCSI, and we support file-based storage, so things like SMB. Now, as we take a look at our heartbeat settings, we recommend kind of considering adjusting these values a little bit. Now, this is flexible based on your preferences. Again, you've got to consider things such as network latency. But if you kind of think about the distance which a network packet has to travel with guest clustering, we've got to go send the information, usually through a virtual switch. Now, if your guest cluster is on a single node, then it's just going to share it within that same local virtual switch. You probably don't really need to adjust these settings too much. But if you have a guest cluster which is split across different physical hosts, that VM has to go through the virtual network adapter, the physical network adapter, back to another physical network adapter, back to another virtual switch to the VM. So we actually have kind of several different layers of networking that we have to go traverse. So for that reason, best practice might be that you need to go and adjust these heartbeat settings. We also get asked the question a lot. We actually addressed this earlier. Can I combine host clustering and guest clustering? Absolutely. Gives you the highest availability possible, as long as, again, everything passes validation. Can we go and mix our physical and virtual nodes? Absolutely. Again, as long as everything passes validation. And as Eldon mentioned, one of the kind of key scenarios here is using a physical server as your primary node, and then using a VM just as a backup as kind of a temporary solution. Another time we see this often used is if you have limited hardware, you're in dev test, just want to kind of try things out on a cluster. Probably the biggest thing that you need to be aware of if you are doing guest clustering is that Hyper-V does have a limitation on nested virtualization. What this means is I can run a VM on a physical server, but I cannot run a VM from within a VM. So there's only one level of virtualization you can do. Now, the reason why this is important is, let's say you're doing dev test in this scenario where I have one physical server and my VM is backup. If I have a SQL application, no problem. That's going to move between them. But if I have a VM that's the clustered application, that will run on the physical server, but that VM isn't going to run on the other VM. Again, VMs cannot run within VMs. Let's talk a little bit about the shared VHDX here. Now, this was really designed to try to simplify our hoster experience here. Actually, Eldon, you've articulated this to me really well. What was the challenge that hosters used to see in the past when they were trying to go provide guest clusters to their tenants?
Yeah, so I mean, ultimately, hosters don't want to present the underlying storage infrastructure up to the individual tenants. So they want this layer of abstraction between the tenants. You don't have to, if I'm a hoster, to create a LUN on my SAN just to present up to a tenant. You want to abstract absolutely everything. So that's about creating and that layer abstraction is a VHDX. So it's about creating a VHDX, and then I can create multiple VHDXs for multiple, I don't have to create one LUN per tenant. So I can have a single LUN with multiple VHDXs and present them up to multiple tenants.
So basically, instead of using like a traditional physical LUN for the two VMs, we can now have one massive physical LUN, a bunch of virtualized disks within them, our VHDs, and go create those VMs to the VHD, VM to the VHD, VM to the VHD. So we're really, again, adding that layer of abstraction, hiding things, simplifying that hoster experience. So definitely something to consider if you're building guest clusters. Configuring this in the GUI, relatively simple. We can go through our VM settings, enable this as virtual hard disk sharing. And we got to make sure that we enable that through both nodes. As we take a look at how this is exposed, it just looks like a regular disk to the VM. Now, if you go and use System Center Virtual Machine Manager, we can actually go and configure this through the service templates as well. There's an option here to share the disk across the service tier. Then you specify the name of that shared VHDX file. So some considerations here. We're really focusing on using shared VHDX for our Hyper-V host, for file servers, for guest cluster nodes. So you're just going to make sure that you use this for that shared data disk, not the host operating system. And so again, when we're talking about the shared data disk, this is going to be the SQL database. So VM node 1 accesses SQL database, VM node 2 accesses that same shared SQL database. Again, this is that data disk for the cluster, not the operating system or anything like that. It does have to use VHDX, not VHD. VHDX is what we generally recommend for all of our customers deploying virtual machines, more resilient, things like that. Fixed disk or dynamic disks are supported, not differencing. And so if you go and actually compare our different guest cluster options, whether you're using shared VHDX, Fiber Channel, or iSCSI to the guest, you see that shared VHDX does have a little more flexibility. We support more different types of backend storage. And, you know, as Eldon mentioned, the key scenario for this is not having to expose that underlying storage fabric to tenants which are using those virtual machines. Now, one consideration that we get asked a lot what if I want to go build a Windows Server failover cluster on top of a VMware infrastructure? Well, you got to be kind of careful with this consideration. While it's fully supported, ESX does actually have quite a lot of limitation on Windows Server guest clusters running on top of it here. They only support 5 node clusters as opposed to 64. You can't do vMotion, what's equivalent to a live migration. You can't do memory ballooning, which is our equivalent to dynamic memory. So while guest clustering is supported in the VMware world, just be really careful that you're actually pretty limited. I mean, if you can't even vMotion or live migration your VM, you're really eliminating a lot of the benefits of doing that. From Microsoft's perspective, we treat guest clusters just like those physical clusters. 64 nodes, full live migration support, everything that you really want to have in an enterprise solution. Let's go ahead and actually go over to our demo now. I'm going to quickly walk you through creating a guest cluster just so you can see it's pretty much the same thing. So I'm going to go switch over to my other computer here. And what I'm actually using here is my laptop. This isn't a server. This is Windows Client 8.1, just a regular computer. But one of the great things about Windows Client, it supports Hyper-V. So in this case, this is one of my test environments. I've actually built a lot of VMs here that are going to be used as hands-on labs. And as a developer, I'm now able to go and test and just use this environment, and I can create guest clusters on top of this. Eldon, can you talk a little bit about Windows Client and how that is supported in failover clustering as a host? Or not.
It's not. Yeah. So failover clustering, so even though Hyper-V is available on the client SKUs, failover clustering is available in all server SKUs, whether it be standard edition, data center, the free Hyper-V server SKU, but we're not available in the client SKU. So you can't make a VM highly available with client.
And there are also limitations for Hyper-V, like you can't do replication, you can't do live migration from a client machine as well. Really designed to be built for a guest. Regardless of that, though, really wanted to kind of show you this just to show you some of the flexibility of Hyper-V. Here's one of my VMs. Within this VM, I've got failover clustering enabled. I've got my second VM. I've got failover clustering enabled. As I go take a look at my virtual switch settings here, we'll launch Virtual Switch Manager. I see that I have a bunch of virtualized networks. These are going to be my cluster networks. We can see I've got a cluster storage network, cluster corp network, and then some application networks for my cluster as well. And then creating this cluster, we just go through a very similar wizard. Create my cluster. Confirm. What are the names of the servers? Add them. It's going to do those same tests. Again, everything's virtualized, kind of that consistent experience. We'll skip our validation test. Validation still required for support. Call this our cluster Hyper-V. Assign it with an IP address. Now, one thing you'll notice that's different in this particular setup from my earlier one is I'm actually prompted for my IP address here. When I created the cluster in my first demo, I didn't get prompted. The reason for that is DHCP. In my primary main environment, I have a DHCP server, so we automatically assign an IP address. In this demo environment running on my laptop, I don't have a DHCP server, so I'm going to go manually enter that IP address.
And the cluster wizard's smart enough, so it actually looks at your underlying storage networking topology, and then if you're using DHCP, it goes, oh, you like DHCP? Let's just go with DHCP. And if you have static, it goes, oh, you like static, and then prompts you. So the wizard's actually dynamic and intelligent based on the core operating system configuration.
Now, I still have a domain controller. That's still a requirement, at least in this configuration where I'm just using standard cluster creation. But click finish, and I've just gone and built a fully virtualized cluster.
On top of a client SKU.
On top of Windows Client, exactly.
Yes.
We can take a look at our different networks here. We've got our storage network, and we've got our cluster connection network. So everything's already pre-configured. So kind of key point here. That's a really consistent experience. Don't be afraid of creating these guest clusters. You got some other considerations around storage, but for the most part, you're going to have the same experience. With that, that wraps up our section on virtualization running on top of a cluster. Make sure you join our next section where we're going to be talking about disaster recovery, because the very first part of that is still going to stay focused on Hyper-V, because we're going to be talking about the Hyper-V replica role and how to build that on a cluster. We'll see you soon.